friends. Hello, everybody. Hello, Lou.
Hello, good morning.
So today we are going to continue our talk about chapter 1 on the Gita. And I just wanted to bring you all up to date that usually most translations of the Gita eliminates chapter 1, goes straight to chapter 2. And there's a reason for that. I often wondered why the Vyasa, who wrote the Gita or composed the Gita, wonder why he put this kind of a chapter 1. Basically, because if you start to look at it or read it, it's all about who was in this side of the Kauravas and who was on that side of the Pandavas, all the warriors, their descriptions, stuff like that. And often people find that boring and not really pertinent to what the Gita is all about. And I don't know the reason, but if you can actually tease out from there certain things, you will find that in today's session, what we're going to be talking about is the ego, and how it distracts us, attachment, arrogance, anger, stuff like that, that you can squeeze out of chapter one. But please bear with it, because chapter one may not be the most effective chapter in the whole of Gita. So just, but it's an introduction. And oftentimes I think about how Vyasa must have done this so as to draw it out more as a story. After all, don't forget that the Upanishads and the Vedanta are really the cream of everything that is spiritual. But if you read those, you will find it impossible to understand. In fact, when the British first came to India and they were looking at all these things, they said the Upanishads and Vedanta was the ramblings of an early childhood of civilization. Uh-huh. They didn't understand what it was, and so they said this is just early civilization or mankind just rambling about stupid things.
Right.
And yet the Upanishads and Vedanta is the highest philosophy you're going to ever find. When Vyasa found that people didn't really understand the Upanishads or the Vedanta, he figured that he should write something. This was about 3000 BCE that he composed the Gita. I keep saying write something, but there was no writing at that time.
Right.
And I'll tell you how the Gita was propagated. But he figured that he would write it more compose it more as a story. So he composed the Mahabharata, which is a war between the Kauravas and the Pandavas, the Kauravas being 100 cousins and the Pandavas being 5 of their cousins fighting for righteousness. So we'll come to that. Mm-hmm. And so that's really what chapter 1 is all about, the fighting between the Pandavas and the Kauravas. The person that we're most concerned about in the Pandavas is Arjun, A-R-J-U-N, Arjuna, who is listening to the sermon given to him by his cousin Krishna, who is a self-realized person riding his chariot. Now, there's this movie called Bagger Vance. Have you heard of it?
I've heard of it.
It's about a guy who's like, who is it, Will Smith, I think?
Will Smith,
of his earlier stages, he acts as a golf caddy, and he's walking behind this golfer and telling him things about how golf is supposed to be played, and it's more about the mind than actual physical aspects. Now, Bagger Vance comes from the word Bhagawan. Bhagawan means God, and Sri Krishna is Bhagawan, mm-hmm. And God. And so Bagger Vance is really God, that's who Will Smith is. And the person he's giving advice to, the guy who's playing the golf in the movie, his name is Juna. J-U-N-A, that's his last name, Arjuna. Wow. So basically he's Arjuna. And Will Smith is
Krishna.
So that's what this is all about. And Arjuna, at that time, when a warrior said, I'm a warrior, he came from a family of warriors, he was the highest and best warrior of all. I mean, cowardice was absolutely not accepted.
Right.
Better to die. And that's where harakiri comes from with the Japanese, because they followed it after the Indian code of war. So warriors were not cowards. And Arjuna was the bravest, most accomplished warrior of all. And he had been so wronged by his cousins, the Kauravas, that he had planned this war for 13 years while hiding in the forest before he attacked. And it was a massive army that he had, which was still smaller than what the Kauravas had, but still a massive army. And then he goes in between for the war, says to Krishna, drive my chariot between the two armies, the Kaurava army and Pandava army, sits there, and then starts to get a panic attack. Mm-hmm. Drops his bow, arrow, sword, and says, I can't fight this. I'd rather be thought of as a coward than to fight. These are my cousins. This is my family. I cannot fight them. And that, all of this is symbolic. Vyasa was a very brilliant, possibly self-realized person that communicated this to us. At that time, 3,000 years BCE, whether it was out of design or whether it was because we didn't have paper and pencil, he composed it and said, it is going to be transmitted over the years verbally. Mm-hmm. So there's 700 verses in the Gita.
Wow.
700. And they're not easy verses. But he dedicated each chapter or each verse or whatever to a different family. So at that time, there were many students that he had. And each student was like a rishi, a sadhu. And from him came a whole lineage. So for instance, I come from the Kaundinya Gotra. So there was a guru, a priest, a sadhu, a rishi, whose name was Kaundinya. So the lineage that came from Kaundinya had to learn such and such verses. And they, for the rest of eternity, would keep teaching their children and grandchildren to be able to say these verses. So
right.
That every single word, every single verse has been preserved. And now, of course, it's in book form, so people can just look at the verses.
But at the time, it was preserved individually in each line and then exchanged?
And exchanged.
Oh,
and there were other families that were taught to say it backwards. So that if somebody forgot, they had another family that says, no, I know this backwards.
Wow.
So it was a complicated way of preserving it. Mm-hmm. And some people said that there was actually discussions of floods and the Great Flood and other things, you know, Ice Age, so on. And he said, listen, we don't want to take a chance of carving it into rock or carving it onto bark. We just want to transmit it orally.
Right.
Brilliant, in my mind.
Yes.
So, for you, the audience, I would suggest that instead of memorizing it, you buy a book. And the book that I find very, very helpful, I've seen a lot of translations of the Gita, I've read them, but I have learned from Swami Parthasarathi's book, which is the translation of the Gita. There's many, many books he has written, and I've learned from my teacher, Gautam Jain, who was here last week. You can get that if you are in India or anywhere else in the world from VedantaWorld.org, VedantaWorld.org. And if you're here in the United States, you can get it from VedantaUSA.org. And if anything, you can just get the three volumes of the Bhagavad Gita. And I think the newer printing has just one large volume. When I bought it, it was three separate volumes.
Mm-hmm.
So I would suggest that you get it and read it, because I cannot do justice to a whole chapter here in 1 hour.
Right.
When we studied under Gautam Jain, it would be weeks of 1 hour lectures each, and each word, each line from each verse was dissected, and it's just so brilliant.
Interesting.
But that would take,
yeah.
I mean, it took years and years for that. For you who are listening, you probably need a summary and then take up the studies. And you can get all these online too. Gautam Jain and Swami Parthasarathi have these videos online, and Swamiji also has CDs of the Gita that you can look at. So, as I said, chapter one is not even translated in many of the books. And so today we're going to touch upon it briefly. So before I do that, and we get to attachment and arrogance and so on, recognize that in today's world, we are all, almost all of us, except those who are self-realized, who go up to the Himalayas to get away from the rest of us so that they can meditate. The rest of us are looking after our drives, are for wherever our vasanas take us. Our drives, our desires, our vasanas push us towards either money or fame or power or beauty, those kind of things. So even the richest, most powerful, most famous, most beautiful people who have accomplished everything still continue to strive for more riches, more power, more fame, more beauty. And as a result, they are unhappy with whatever they accomplish. They suffer from sleeplessness, anxiety, depression, constantly being jealous of somebody else who has a little bit more than them, no matter how. And we see this in President Trump. You know, no matter how much he has, it's not enough. We saw that from so many people. And then the other thing is, I don't even need to go into names, but people who are extremely wealthy drop the wealth and then they start for another vasana.
Right.
You know, they're looking for power, for politics, they want to run, and then they just get so bitter that they lost something else. So the Gita teaches us that there is no permanent happiness in the material world, in the external world. Mm-hmm. So there's us internally, where our Atman is really pushing us, and there's the external world. And we keep looking for happiness in the external world,
right,
looking for money, power, fame, etc. And even after we get it, let's say we think, okay, if I have $1 million, I'll be very happy.
Right.
You get the million, now you say, okay, I need another million, I need more millions. And then after you get hundreds of millions, now you say, okay, now I want to be a politician,
yeah,
or I want to be a film star, whatever. So there's no permanent happiness in the external world, yet we don't learn from our mistakes. We keep learning, keep seeking for happiness in the same thing that you've been programmed to search for, because
right,
your vasanas push you that way. You don't see, well, you know, now I have $100 million, I should be happy. No, you still trying to get another 100 million.
Right.
Somebody had said, Gautam had said this in his class, that a student of his basically said to him, he was living in this penthouse apartment in Manhattan, and he said, you know, I'm now 40 years old, I have lots of money, I'm staying in this beautiful place, and I'm unhappy.
Hmm.
I don't sleep well, I'm anxious, I'm depressed, I'm constantly stressed out, I go to the gym, I go to the doctors. If you had asked me when I was 20, what would make you really happy, I would have said, if I have what I do have today,
right,
if and when I get it, I'd be very happy.
Right.
Now that I have it, I'm not happy. So we should learn from our own selves, look back and say, look, what do I have today? What did I think I would have? What would be my state of mind if,
right,
20 years ago I thought this? So we don't look elsewhere. We don't look within ourselves. And this Gita, my friends, is going to teach you that. So after getting the knowledge of the Gita, I can tell you from personal experience that your life will change. You sleep better, you feel better, you don't have anxiety, and you don't have depression. You'll be more productive at work. Your work becomes laser sharp, and you become more successful, and everything else follows that goes with that. Why does that happen? And I can tell you this, if you don't know what I'm talking about, go back and look at some of the sessions before where I've explained the basics. The intellect is the king, supposedly, but he's asleep on his throne. The mind has taken over. The
yes.
mind is full of emotions, and the mind says, I want this, I want this, I want this. And as long as the mind is in control and not the intellect, your production is not good, because you're and you'll see from Arjuna, and the golfer in
Bagger Vance, yep.
You know, what Will Smith tells him, what Krishna tells Arjuna, is that as long as you let your emotions control you, you're not going to be successful. When that is removed, your intellect can be laser sharp in what you're getting. And the real king comes, wakes up, takes control of the mind, and doesn't mean you cannot indulge, but you have to indulge in small, short bursts. For instance, the mind says, I want to eat a great meal. You can eat. That's a natural, normal, physiological need. The intellect says, go ahead and eat. You go to a Chinese restaurant, you say, my goodness, this is the best Chinese food I've ever had anywhere. But then stop. Eat it, go, and Don't think about it. In the Hindu tradition, I think it's also the same in Christianity and other religions, you're basically saying this food that I'm eating is not for me, it is for a higher power. So I am donating the food that I'm eating and the pleasure of it to a higher power. It's not for me. So I'm not going to linger. It's called lingering.
Okay.
So that when you leave the restaurant, if you say, oh my God, that food was so good, and you tell somebody else about it, tell somebody else, you dream about it, you think about it, it gets further power to your vasanas.
Right.
So your mind keeps saying, I want to go back to that restaurant. And if you do, you're not going to be happy because it says, yeah, it was not the same as last time.
Yep.
And you've become neutralized to that food and you don't have the same pleasure from it. It does not relive, and you want to keep going back there again and again to try to duplicate that. So by studying about the Gita, your intellect becomes more powerful. That starts to control your mind. So you can enjoy that Chinese food, but then don't linger on it.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you do, the desire for indulgence keeps coming up. So now let's talk about the war itself. Arjuna sits in the chariot. Krishna is driving the chariot. He's got the reins in his hand. He's got the five horses that he's pulling, which, if you remember, I told you symbolically, the five horses are the five senses.
Mm-hmm.
The reins are the mind,
right,
which are, when loose, the horses run any way they want. Krishna, self-realized, Atman, or God, is sitting there holding the reins tightly and controlling the horses. So
right,
the intellect is controlling, and Arjuna, who's sitting in the back as the passenger, is really the Atman or us.
Yes.
We are the Atman. So in...
Is it fair to say the intellect is using the mind to control the emotions?
He's not using the mind. The intellect is not mm-hmm, not using the mind. It is basically controlling the mind.
Okay.
Because mind has its own functions.
Right.
Because, for example, all of these things we're going to be talking about today are emotions, which are a product of the mind. And you can't stop the mind from having these emotions.
Right.
But the intellect can control what the mind does with those emotions.
Yes.
For example, talking about attachments. Attachments drive you to different things.
Sure.
I'm attached to money, so I go there. I'm attached to movies, I go there. I'm attached to sound and light. All of the senses, right, want something. Think about the analogy of a supermarket. These today's modern supermarkets here, when you go there, there's like 50 aisles.
Right.
One aisle is for dairy. One aisle is for meats. One aisle is for bakery, baked goods, children's
right,
items, pets items, you know, things for your car. Now, if I don't have any children, I look at aisle number 7, it says children's goods, I don't go there.
Right.
There's one aisle less. I say, I don't have a car, I don't go there. I don't have a pet, I don't go there. So if you rid yourself of all of these attachments, imagine how simple your life becomes. Because you don't have to go onto every little thing, you just take care of your thing, what you ought to do, and that's it. Whereas what we tend to do is to just pile on ourselves more and more and more of these attachments. In this chapter 1, there's a lot of people recognized. One of them is Dhritarashtra. Now, the name is complicated. These are names from 5,000 years
yes,
ago. I don't know that today we use that name as much, but Dhritarashtra is the king. And he's infatuated with his sons, who are the Kauravas. And these sons, he's infatuated with them even though they are so evil, so bad. They're greedy, they're evil-minded, they're sinful. The Pandavas, the five brothers, on the other hand, are virtuous. And Dhritarashtra, in chapter 1, represents the mind. And Kauravas, the 100 of them,
mm-hmm,
his sons, represent the bad tendencies that we each have.
Right.
We have hundreds of bad tendencies. So the mind is allied with the bad tendencies. Not necessarily our good tendencies.
Right.
What are the good tendencies? Generosity, kindness, love, tenderness, all of these things. The bad are greed, lust, power, desire for other things,
right,
all those kind of evil things. Now, the mind is more in cahoots with the bad tendencies of each one of us. So the mind tends to say, nah, forget, right. I'd rather do this. If I have $10 and I want to spend it, right. I'd say instead of being charitable and giving it to somebody, could I maybe buy this with it that I want?
Right.
So the Kauravas represent the evil tendencies in a human being, greed, anger, lust, jealousy, etc. The Pandavas represent the good tendencies, kindness, love, generosity, etc. And the mind is ever attracted to the negative tendencies. And as a result, there's an incessant conflict in each one of us human beings between the good and the bad. And that's really the significance of the war, that there's a conflict right. between the good, the Pandavas, and the bad, the Kauravas, within each one of us.
And it's set up that the bad tendencies are overpowering.
They're overpowering. There are more of them. Mm. They're more powerful, etc. However, as is said in the chapter one, we each know when we have done something bad. Remember we talked about sukshma buddhi, which is the intellect not at the gross level, which is terrestrial, but higher level than that, which we call the conscience.
Right.
There is a part of our conscience that says you've done something bad.
Yeah.
This is a bad tendency, you gave into it, and it keeps bothering you. So that when you come across somebody who has done something bad, like the Kauravas, and they're faced with somebody who is good, the bad, even though they have more power, tends to know that because of their bad deeds, they are inferior to right. the good. And that will show itself in chapter one.
Guilt.
So fear arises out of the guilt of wrongdoing. So what the Gita teaches us, starting in chapter one, is who am I? How does my mind work? How does my intellect function? And it teaches us that you and I and everybody else is not really who we think we are. We are the Atman. I may look a certain way, you may look a certain way, sorry. But really, next life, I come back, I may look very different. Right. I will look different. It won't be the same. But I am the same. The Atman is the same. My vasanas are the same. They come back with me. Mm-hmm. But my mind is different. My intellect is different. But my vasanas are the same and my intellect is the same. So you must remember, you are not who you think you are or what you think you are. You are the Atman within you, which enlivens you.
And that is you. You are not your mind.
You're not your mind.
Right.
Your mind is a part of what you're thinking about. The Atman is you.
It's the difference between thinking I am angry and I feel angry.
Right.
Yeah.
So
the observer understanding that the mind is not you. That right. mind is just feeding you stimulus.
Correct. So if the analogy of a car at that time filled with petrol or gas, and you're driving the car, and it could be a Mercedes, it could be a Hyundai, could be a small car, big car, an ambulance, a police right. truck, whatever. But think that you are the Atman.
Yep.
The Atman is really the petrol that enlivens the car. Because of the petrol or the gas, mm-hmm. I say it petrol because there's a lot of people in India listening to
sure.
this, the petrol or the gas enlivens the car, gives it energy to, once the Atman leaves the body, is no longer a part of it, the body dies.
Right.
Once the petrol is finished, the car doesn't move. The petrol makes the car move. But it's the person driving the car that determines whether he's going to go 100 miles an hour or 60 miles an hour,
right.
Whether he's going to go left or right. So we make those decisions. So the mind that you were talking about before is the one that determines the course of our actions. Really should be the intellect.
Yes.
Should be the guy driving the car. But it's essentially the mind often takes over. And where the car goes...
Well, we don't differentiate these days.
We don't
People don't
know.
Understand there's an intellect above the mind.
Absolutely. Yeah. Most people... And that's the purpose of the teachings of the Gita.
Mm-hmm.
So Krishna goes through 700 verses of the Gita with Arjuna. 700. And...
In this, the battlefield between the two?
That's the point. That he actually parks this chariot right in the middle between the two armies.
Mm-hmm.
That shows you that this is symbolic.
Yes.
There may really have been a Mahabharata war, but no doubt that it doesn't take 5 minutes to go through 700 verses, especially right. such high philosophy. So that part has to be symbolic, where the chariot is in the middle, both right. the armies are waiting. They're not sitting there, you know, eating yeah. Snickers bars while you say, okay, go ahead and talk.
While these two are having a conversation.
Right. Yeah. So Krishna goes through the 700 verses of the Gita in the middle of the battlefield and to teach Arjuna about life and how to deal with it and how to face it and face life's vicissitudes. Arjuna represents each one of us. That's what Vyasa was doing when he composed this.
He's the protagonist.
Mm-hmm. He was a highly qualified individual in his own field, which is war. He was the best warrior there is. But one particular challenge of life caused him to collapse. He goes there after 13 years of planning. He's fought many, many battles. He's called the undefeated. So he's not a coward.
Right.
He goes there and ready to fight, eager to fight. And then he looks at his cousins and he says, these are my relatives. These are my cousins. I can't fight them. And he collapses. And the stress and strain of his emotions, he cannot face. And that leads to strife, disease, illness. And that's really what happens to us. I remember talking about the Gita to somebody who was going through a minor problem. And he's talking to me and I'm saying, you know, you really should learn the Gita. It'll help you face these small things as you come across them. And this was a very close friend, relative. And he said to me, he says, what do I need to do this? I'll spend years because when a climax comes, when a challenge comes, I'll learn it at that time.
Yeah.
And I said to him, that's like saying, you know, when I get into a fight, I'll learn taekwondo, karate, judo at that time. It
exactly.
doesn't work. You've
yeah.
got to know it ahead of time. Another example.
And it takes a long time to be strong at this, to be able
right.
to do this well.
So it doesn't happen overnight. Everybody that's listening to this is yeah. not going to get this in just one. It has to be repeated. It's like going, playing the piano. It's like learning.
It's not a light switch moment. In other words, you
Absolutely.
Don't get this enlightenment and then all of a sudden everything's okay.
Correct.
Because you're continually challenged.
Right. I doubt that any of us listening here is going to get enlightenment.
Yeah.
But I say if I can move 1 inch on the scale of a few miles, I'm happy mm-hmm. because I can see what a difference it's made to me. I'm like a first grader in
yes.
this.
Yeah.
I was not even in kindergarten when I started this. I've now moved to first grade. I'm very happy. I couldn't be happier. And this is my karma to teach other people. But now let's talk about attachment.
Mm-hmm.
Drona has one weakness. Even though he is a great warrior and very accomplished in war, he's on the Kaurava side,
mm-hmm.
he's attached to his son. This attachment destroys him. He's so attached. And we see this with ourselves. When you attach to one thing, you can't think logically.
Right.
Everything becomes emotion. Whenever you're attached, you magnify the danger and fear of the consequences, whenever you're attached.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not attached, you're able to make a decision more logically. You magnify the danger, fear the consequences, you become incapacitated, as did Arjuna. Selfish attachment to objects and people causes anxiety, fear, and insecurity. Now, attachment is an emotion. Attachment to anything is an emotion. I love, it's an emotion.
Right.
I hate, it's an emotion. I'm attached to, is an emotion. And it arises, as do all emotions, in the mind. When you strengthen your intellect, it keeps the mind and its emotions in check. So Drona had this attachment, and because of that, he couldn't fight the way he or his sons would have fought if it were not for the attachment.
Right.
If you're doing it because you ought to do it. In chapter 1, verse 5 and 6, now we're going to go through the verses. There's about 44 verses in chapter 1. I can't go verse by verse,
sure.
So I'm just going to touch on the most important ones. In verse 5 and 6, he continues with a list of warriors, so I'm going to skip over that. In verse 7, he talks about arrogance. He says, my army is so great compared to the Pandavas, the Kauravas are talking,
right.
My army. And whenever you do that, there's really, it belies an underlying anxiety about the other. Because you're saying, my army is so great, you really have
right.
a wonder whether it's really going to be able to fight the Pandavas. The first sign of spiritual development is the dissolution of your ego. In order to develop, one of the first signs is dissolution of your ego. Your ego is always mine. This is me. I'm so great. My this. This is my room. This is my car. That kind of thing.
Right.
You stop seeking praise from others. You want people, when you're not spiritually evolved or start to get present. And when I say you don't have to be self-realized, which is like 1,000 miles there.
Right.
If you go 1 inch on that scale, you say, okay, I don't need that praise. I don't need when you make a donation, you don't want your name up there. You just say, okay, this is a donation because it's the right thing to do,
right. Anonymous.
You stop seeking praise, you start acknowledging the contribution of others. So you start, how many of us think that what I am today is because somebody taught me to read? If it weren't for that, do I even remember the name of the teacher who taught me to read, or who taught me this, or who taught me to write, who taught me to draw, who taught me to ride a bicycle, who taught me to do various things? I have to be grateful to all those people who made me am. No, but instead, I did it. I did it.
Yeah.
So that's a sign of spiritual evolution, and that's what the Gita tells you. To first start working on your own arrogance. We encourage instead our likes and dislikes. So the Gita calls it raga and dvesha. Mm-hmm. These are two words in Sanskrit that basically say I like and I dislike. Instead of saying I'm going to do what I like to do, the Gita says do what you ought to do. So the mind is the one that determines what do you like, what do you not like.
Right.
And the mind says I like this, so let's do that. The intellect says, I don't like this, but this is what I ought to do. Go with what your intellect is telling you.
Right.
Decide first what is the right thing to do, and then do that. So that's verse 7.
Yes.
Verse 8 is ego. I am superior. Mm. That's what this Kaurava soldier says. The more the ego in a person, the more his disturbance because of his ego, and the more agitation. You constantly think because of your ego, and you want to sustain it with gas, petrol from other people.
Right.
You want others to think of you as you think of yourself. That's a fallacy. That's a pitfall. You want others to think of you.
Right.
People think what they want to think.
You're seeking praise to fuel that feeling that you're superior.
You want that praise. You want that ego. You want that self-centeredness to keep getting fueled. So, as an example, you should buy what you need to buy for yourself.
Right.
Instead, you buy what you think others will be impressed by.
Right.
So, you buy what you think others will be impressed by. And people who are egotistical are naturally selfish and self-centered. And those are the two qualities that we want to get rid of.
Sure. That's a full-time job. Feeding your ego.
Yeah. They just boost the ego. The more selfish you are, the more self-centered you are, the more your ego gets boosted. The next verse has to do with fear. The more selfish you are, the more fearful and anxious you become.
Yes.
Sorry?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, for instance, people in this country, they were talking about bird flu. Right?
Yes.
Swine flu. We didn't even have it here at the time. It was in the Far East. It was in China. People were going through headlines and fearful and all of that. And you say, well, what exactly are you afraid of? If it's in China, you feel empathy and sympathy for those people there. But what are you so scared of? I remember people coming to my office and talking to me about the fear that bird flu would come here.
Right.
Basically, the underlying fear is what happens if it happens to me?
Mm-hmm.
What if it comes here and I get it?
Right.
So if you stop thinking about yourself, and this is just one example, the fear and anxiety starts to diminish. People who are self-realized have no fear. They have no anxiety. And if you read Lives of a Himalayan Master, talks about a person that was living in the Himalayas, studying from the Himalayan masters, who are all self-realized, and he's studying there. And he learns how, without fear, if you walk through a jungle with tigers and wild animals and snakes and so on, they don't bother you because they don't see you as a threat. It's only when you become selfish and fearful, you actually say, somebody's going to attack me because your desire is to attack them. They don't touch you, wild animals and so on. That's in the book. So verse 9, Vyasa talks about when a person has an ego, they think they know.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a result. This is another aspect of relationships that the Gita talks about. So that when somebody, and this is all in symbolic ways in the Gita, how when Arjuna keeps talking and talking and talking, you see Krishna hasn't said a word so far.
Yes.
It's all Arjuna talking. And he keeps quiet. So when a person has an ego, they think that they know, only they know.
Right.
This is what happens in an argument. When you're having an argument with your spouse or anybody else, there's no point in arguing with the other person who says, I know what I'm talking.
Right.
They're not going to listen because they think they know. Fights only occur between people because one person thinks he or she knows. If both people say that, then they're going to fight.
Right.
Neither one is going to listen. So better to do what Krishna does, just keep quiet. And in the Gita, at some point when Krishna doesn't say anything, Arjuna says to him, well, what do you think? That's when Krishna's sermons start. Until that time, he's quiet. He lets Arjuna just keep rambling on
right.
about why it is necessary in Arjuna's mind to give up his fight and walk away. Krishna doesn't start, no, you can't do that. You have to
right.
fight. He doesn't say that. So in verse 14 is the first mention of Arjuna and Krishna. Till verse 13, the first 13 verses of chapter 1 is all names of different people in the Kaurava part. In this, the verse 14, it mentions Krishna as Rishikesha. Rishikesha means the Lord of the senses, and that's the Atman.
Mm-hmm.
Who controls all the senses? It is the Atman.
Right.
Is the Lord. Rishi, Rishka, means senses. Ish means Lord of. Ish of the Rishka is Rishikesha. So in India, we have names like Yogesh, Ramesh. Yogesh means Ish of Yoga, the chief of Yoga. Ramesh means Ish of Ram. And only in verse 14, when we see, it's like a drama being played on a stage.
Right.
When verse 14 comes, you say Krishna is sitting at the chariot, and Krishna is Rishikesha, which is Lord of the senses. You then are given a glimpse into that Krishna is a self-realized soul. He's essentially the Atman itself. So all anxiety, depression, and fear are related to selfishness, as we discussed. What if this happens to me? What will happen to my possessions, my money, my power, my health, my child? And as you give up the selfishness, the fear leaves you. You stop thinking about yourself. There's no fear or anxiety. This is a secret in life that I can tell you is true. In verse 19, it talks about wrongdoers being afraid of the righteous when confronted. We just talked about that.
Yes.
Because if you go against your conscience, your sushma buddhi, then you will be afraid. No matter what power you have, what you possess, wrongdoers cannot enjoy the fruit of their wrong action because their own conscience is bothering them from the back.
Right.
And that impedes their performance. How much time do we have, Lou?
We're 38 in. So
okay, good. So verse 20 and 21. Arjuna is the greatest warrior that we have seen to this
right.
point. He has been planning this war for 13 years, but in a few minutes, he's going to panic and lose his determination. And this happens to us in day to day. We succumb to our fears. And in verse 21 and 22, as Arjuna's anxiety starts to build, he says to Krishna, place my chariot between the two armies so I can think. He's mighty, he's ready, he's been ready for 13 years. He says, place my chariot in the middle. And this also is a different form of symbolization of the war, because the five Pandavas represent the five sense organs
right.
and the five organs of action, and the 100 Kauravas represent hundreds of temptations and stimuli, and the chariot and Krishna and Arjuna is the individual, you and I.
Right.
We cannot control our losses, but we can strengthen our intellect and control how we deal with the approach to these losses. So each one of us has a point at which we fall.
Yes.
So Gautam had given an example when I, among the first lectures that I attended, he said to the audience, he said, imagine you have a ballpoint pen, like a Montblanc.
Yes.
A good one.
Yes.
You lose it. What is going to happen to you? And everybody raised their hand and said, I'll be upset.
Yeah.
Because it's an object to which you're attached.
Mm-hmm.
You say, okay, fine. You get, as your ego develops, sorry, not your ego, as you spiritually develop, your ego, your attachment starts to diminish, your arrogance starts to diminish, the I-ness, the mindness starts to diminish. You say, Montblanc doesn't bother me as much. I'll give you an example. I had 5 watches that I had over the years been given as gifts. Each one of them was a very valuable watch.
Yes.
And I wanted to get it, take it to the mall and get it, change the batteries, get it clean, serviced, etc., because I never wear them.
Right.
I don't wear watches. So I said, you know, it's nice to wear it as a decorative piece. So I put it in the car, and I took the car for car wash.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, wax it, and I'll come back. I left the watches in the car. When I came back, they were gone.
Yeah.
And I talked to the owners, and they said, well, you know, you shouldn't have left it there, but now we don't know who took it.
Right.
There's so many people working here. We'll try and find out. But they never found
it. Sure.
What can you do? Had it been a few years ago, 10 years ago, whatever, I would have been mad and depressed and so on.
Right.
I tell you honestly, it didn't bother me. And I, not that I'm saying we should all lose things, but that's the benefit of what happens when you get to be learn the Gita, that automatically your way of reacting to losses changes.
Let me ask you, you said it didn't bother you, or did it bother you and you let it go?
You're right.
Yeah.
It. What really bothers me...
Because it's hard not for it to bother you, it's how you deal with how it bothers you, right?
Well, yeah. I'll tell you what bothered me,
mm-hmm.
and that's the difference. The thought of losing thousands of dollars worth of a material like the watches was not what bothered me.
Right.
What bothered me is the fact that there was a vicious, evil person there who would steal something and was going to get away with it.
Yeah.
So the focus of what bothers you also might change. But even that, it left my mind very quickly.
Right.
It bothered other people around me when I told them the story, but really, it didn't bother me.
Right.
What bothered me is more that there was a thief out there who was going to do this to other people. But I didn't do anything about it. It slipped my mind. So the gradation of, you know, where do you fall? Arjuna fell when he had to kill his own cousins, even though they were bad. So Montblanc pen, watches. What if your car gets stolen? Brand new car, you don't have insurance on it, gets stolen. Would that bother you? What if your house burned down and you didn't have insurance on it? Would that bother you?
Mm-hmm.
What if, you know, there's some, Swami Rama said, you know, if there was my roof burned down or my house disappeared in a hurricane,
right.
He says, all the more reason for me to celebrate because now I don't have an obstruction between me and the stars. I can look at the stars and enjoy. I don't think most of us are like that, where Swami Rama was okay with it. But most of us would actually say, no matter what, I have enough. It doesn't matter. Let my car get stolen, even if I don't have insurance. It's okay. I've got plenty. But at some point, what happens if your child, your grandchild, your spouse, your brother, your sister, something happens, they die? We all have at some point at which we succumb and we fall, like Arjuna did.
Right.
And so that is where, by strengthening your ego, I keep saying ego, I mean strengthening your intellect,
mm-hmm.
you get to the point where you can eliminate this attachment. And I'm not to the point where it's my family,
right.
but I'm substantially further along than I was when I started. So I'm in first grade.
What does it say about me that that's usually inverse for me? In other words, the big things, if someone stole my car today, I'd be okay. It's like, it's not what I want, but I'd keep going. But you know what? The store's out of a particular product that I like, that aggravates me. I have a little bit of an inverse there.
Yeah.
Catastrophes I seem to be able to deal with better.
Yeah.
I think that's when I engage this type of thinking.
It's
like, well, I'm okay. My family's okay. Just a car.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Would it bother you if your car was not insured?
Oh, yeah, bother me.
Yeah. So it's... But point is that each one of us has a different point where we fall.
Yeah.
And so we need to figure out where it is that we fall, where it is that we say, and then work towards getting rid of that.
Right.
So the chariot in the middle between the two armies means that if you want to gain spiritual knowledge, you have to be away. Distance yourself from both the bad, which is the core of us, as well as the good.
It's interesting because I was thinking of this from the beginning. It was interesting that he pulled himself away.
Yeah. So even if you want to be your bad, selfish desires, you definitely have to go away. But even you want to do good to the world, you want to do, you know, you immerse yourself in that. And that alone is a distraction.
That can become an attachment,
too. It becomes an attachment, which is okay as long as you're not saying that it is for me.
Right.
So it's a way of doing karma.
Oh, exactly, yeah.
So between the two armies is where the Gita is given out to Arjuna. So instead of seeing the Kauravas as the enemy, what Arjuna, when he falls, it's when he starts seeing them as his family.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another aspect that the Gita teaches us. That when you
Our attachment to our desires?
Personalize something. Mm-hmm. When you personalize, anytime you personalize anything, you get emotionally attached to it.
Yes.
And when you do that, it's hard to do your job. So I remember as a soccer coach, I had both my sons in the team. And when my kids were playing, depending on what position they were playing, I would not be as good a coach because I was emotionally attached to their performance.
Yes.
And I would not direct the rest of the team. And I recognized that in myself. I said, I'm personalizing this. So it's just an example of a thing. And a good example is a surgeon. Now, going through medical school, residency, and being a physician, I know that if you were actually in the surgery operating room, nurses will tell you, anesthesiologists will tell you, medical students, residents will tell you that the surgeons are basically doing their job almost blindfolded. They know what they're doing. They've done it 1,000 times. They complicated surgeries. They've got music playing. They're talking about their vacations. They're saying, where are you going on vacation? Which stock did you buy?
Right.
And they're doing it, and the surgery comes out beautifully. Now think to yourself that the same patient happens to be the surgeon's child. Right? His hands are shaking.
Which is why this doesn't happen, right?
It doesn't happen. Surgeons say, I can't do this. This is. So why? Because now this becomes personal to him. Just like with Arjuna.
Right.
He's battled so many thousands of wars before. But when it comes to fighting somebody, instead of looking at it objectively to say, look, I've thought about this for 13 years. I've tried to negotiate with these evil cousins of mine. They're behaving very badly. They are immoral. Mm-hmm. They've done really bad things, which you will only understand if you read the Mahabharata. I have no choice but to say to them, because I asked them to give up the kingdom to a decent, logic, good ruler. They're not. Now, the only point is to go to war with them, and the Kauravas have invited this war.
Right.
I have no choice but to fight this war. Instead of doing that, he says, nah, they're my family. I'm going to put my weapons down. So the surgeon, if he has no choice, if he has to operate, he'll do it. But his hands are shaking.
Yes.
He finds it hard to do it. Why? Because, again, it's not that you're thinking about the patient, your child. You're saying, God forbid something goes wrong.
Right.
What's going to happen to me?
Yes.
How am I going to deal with that? Again, it comes to this. You would think that you're not able to operate because it's your child. So what? Really, the bottom line is you're thinking, what about me if something goes wrong with this person?
Isn't it interesting how we're all very good at giving people advice, but we never take our own advice?
Right.
Because it's personally attached.
Personally.
When we're dealing with our own situations, it's about us.
Yeah.
When we're advising somebody about their situation, it's about them.
It's about them, right.
Yeah.
When we apply it to ourselves, it's so much harder.
Mm.
Last example I want to give is that of a plank. Imagine that there's a plank just about 12 inches wide.
Mm-hmm.
And I put it on the floor and I say to you, walk on this plank for the next 100 feet.
Yes.
And you say, fine, easy.
Yeah.
You just walk on it without any issues because you say, I can walk on this plank very easily. But then I take the same plank and put it between two buildings, 100 feet high. And it's a big drop. And I say, just walk across this plank. You've done it when it's on the floor, very easy. You can't.
Right.
You go two steps and you start to shake and you say, no, I can't do this. I walk away.
Consequences.
Consequences, not to anybody else but yourself.
Right.
You say, if I make a wrong step, I'm going to fall off that plank and I'm going to die.
Mm-hmm.
Here you say, there's no consequences. I'm going to die. So basically, the other aspect is the surgeon says, look, I'm going to do the best I can, but I don't know how this surgery will turn out. I'm pretty sure it's going to turn out okay. And if something doesn't, you know, I'll feel bad, but it's not going to devastate me.
Mm-hmm.
This is my child. God forbid something goes wrong.
Yes.
I will not be able to live with myself.
Right.
So that is chapter one. Hopefully, friends, you got something out of this. As I said, the chapter one is where, you know, you the least amount of wisdom that you get from the Gita, but I tried, thanks to Swamiji, to get as much of it and put it forward just the way I was taught it. If you need more, you can go to Swamiji's website, VedantaWorld.org, and get his CDs, lectures, books, etc. And I thank you, and hopefully next time we will start on chapter two. Thank you so much.